I was hurt at work today.
I'll have you speak to an attorney.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello?
Hello, yes. I was hurt at work today.
Okay, can you come to see me?
Well, listen to me. I was very hurt today.
Yeah?
Right. Now, my boss, he reprimanded me and said some very vicious things, and I'm very hurt about
this. What do you mean hurt? You were hurt by his words, or you had an injury?
I sustained an injury, but I was initially hurt with his words.
Yeah. That's a very, very sophisticated type of case you have there. Can you come in to see me?
Sure, but listen, he said bad, awful things, and I fell down the stairs, and my shoes fell off.
Uh-huh.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. On today's show, we'll be discussing the second form of doublespeak, jargon. This is where the language that's unique to a trade or a profession is used in conversations with people who don't understand that language because they're not part of that profession or trade, to impress and confuse them. And what better place to explore jargon than the legal system? So we're going to court. Take off your hat and have a seat. This is Discovering Doublespeak Part 3, Legalese versus Curiosity and Critical Thought.
You gentlemen, please try to be a little more quiet in the court.
Certainly, Judgey. The gate is locked.
Will you please step forward? No, no, no. Prepare yourself for the witness box.
Take off your hat. Now raise your right hand. Now place your left hand here.
Take off your hat.
Raise your right hand. Now put your left hand here.
Please take off your hat.
Raise your right hand. Now put your left hand here.
Will you please take off your hat?
Raise your right hand. Now put your left hand here.
Take off your hat.
Raise your right hand. Will you get rid of that hat?
Raise your right hand.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, all the truth, and nothing but the truth?
Huh?
Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, all the truth, and nothing but the truth?
Are you trying to give me the double talk?
I am being joined today by Mark Stevens. His website is markstevens.net. He is also the host of the No State Project that is part of the rotation at LRN. And Mark, you're also actually on the radio too out there, right?
We have a number of affiliates that you can get at the website. But we have a few affiliates and we're on LRN.fm.
Where are you broadcasting from?
I broadcast from Phoenix, Arizona. I usually describe it as the fortified compound, which is goes right in line with what you asked me to talk about today.
Yeah, it must be 275 degrees there today, because in New Hampshire it's got to be 100.
It certainly feels, today, it's over 100 already, and it's 10:30 in the morning here, so it'll get to about 100, between 112 and 150.
And one more thing I should mention, since it's so relevant to what we're going to discuss today, you're also the author of the book Adventures in Legaland, which was written, at this point, several years ago, right?
Yes, I actually released it in early of 2003, so the new book is long overdue.
So can you give us a brief synopsis of what that book covers and what your intentions were?
Sure. What I was trying to do with it was to use real-world experiences and contrast that with the words and the rhetoric and the public relations, as I put on the back of the book, that the people calling themselves government put out, and kind of show the disconnect there, and using that as a method of damage control to produce or provide a working model of how to deal with bureaucrats and politicians and how to limit the damage that they want to do to you. But kind of like getting, I call it legal land because they don't live in the real world. And so that's what I do in the book is I take the two ways that they do business, and which are conflicting. One, they say that the public relations, of course, is that they're benevolent protectors of life, liberty, and property. But when we get away from the abstract, when we actually get away from the words that they use, when we look at their actions, they do business at the barrel of a gun. So I have a model where I just ram those two together and show that they're contradictory.
Right. And just so I can clarify my intentions for this show, this is the third installment of a series that deals with the topic of doublespeak. And today I wanted to talk about jargon. Now, in the legal world, this has its own name. It's called legalese. And, of course, we know that doublespeak is any language that is intended to mislead, distort reality, pretend to communicate but not really communicate, making negative things appear positive, or concealing, corrupting, or preventing actual critical thought from taking place. And there's plenty of that in the legal profession. What I think is interesting is that certainly legalese has plenty of Latin, which, as far as the terminology, to make the language of that profession kind of inaccessible. Like, we all have jargon. Maybe we work in the computer industry or we work in the healthcare industry, and industries have their own jargon. But it doesn't become doublespeak. It doesn't become misleading until people within an industry are interacting with lay people trying to, you know, use the language of the industry to get the upper hand. And if we've ever been in court, kind of feels like we've somehow become a contestant on a game show in a foreign country. Like, there's rules and words and things you need to know that if you're not prepared for that, you really don't stand a chance. Of course, the intention of my show, in addition to pointing out all of the really horrible things about school when it comes to actually educating people, and all of the really wonderful things about school when it comes to serving the needs of the state, is to provide people with some strategies for defending themselves from the kinds of people who are just lining up to take advantage of public school graduates in this country and other countries around the world. I think it starts with, of course, politicians and the media, but there's also bureaucrats, advertisers, marketers, and what we deal with in the legal system. So when did you first start to get into this as far as your research or your experimentation was concerned?
Well, I had a bad experience out in Long Island where I'm from, and, you know, it was a labor dispute, and you talk about doublespeak, look at New York State labor law. Anyway, it turned out that I wound up losing because the court was located in a building owned by the defendant. So that kind of opened up my eyes and started to investigate these things. And one of the things that I had noticed a number of years ago was before the book, and directly related to doublespeak, is when you look at things like the word person, and a person, even though in basic English it is in the singular, you know, one person, it doesn't sound like those person, it's not proper. But the word person is a word of art that they call in law, because it can refer to, you know, an entire population in a given area. Let's say, like, you know, the city of Keene, New Hampshire, is considered legally a person, just like a corporation is considered a legal fiction, a separate legal entity, not connected or comprised of the people that make up the particular corporation, or let's say, or like the city of Keene. It's like a separate thing, and so that kind, you know, that really got me investigating a lot of the words that they were using. And you notice that yes, they use Latin, not so much anymore, and I think it's because Latin has a certain precision, and the reason why they use Latin is because it is a dead language, and it's not an evolving language like English. But they do certainly have stopped, in my experience, do not use the Latin phrases nearly as much, and it has gone really, and you can see from a period of time, maybe 40, 50 years ago, where they just started really hitting the modern-day legalese a lot harder.
Yeah, and I think that Latin is, when you mention the definition for person, that's a really good point. Latin is the least abstruse aspect of legalese today. I mean, I think there's a lot of this Latin vocabulary that's actually, you know, words like pro bono, nolo contendere, modus operandi, that have kind of just become parts of normal English vocabulary. But when you look at a word like person, I actually pulled up the definitions. The ordinary definition from dictionary.com is very clear, human being, whether man, woman, or child, as distinguished from animal or a thing. Individual human being, self-conscious or rational being, the personality of a human being. When you go to the legal definition, number one is a human being. Number two is a corporation treated as having the rights and obligations of a person. Countries and cities can be treated as a person in the same manner as a corporation. However, corporations, countries, and cities cannot have the emotions of humans, such as malice, and therefore are not liable for punitive damages. Huh.
Right. Well, that's when they talk about piercing the corporate veil. So, like what you have going on in with Rupert Murdoch now, trying to hold him accountable for the actions of the people that were under him, because he's the owner of the corporation. You need to pierce the corporate veil in order to get the actual actors that are involved and responsible.
So. One of the things that you've put a lot of effort into is helping people kind of survive this day in court, specifically for traffic violations. Is that correct?
Yes, that traffic and taxes take up the majority of the consultation work that I do.
All right, so without purging too much from your book, which I certainly encourage people to go pick up a copy of, what are some of the things that people should be on the lookout for, should be made aware of before they go into, let's start with traffic court?
Well, the word appearance. I mean, in ordinary English, appearance, you know, you're talking about, so if you appear somewhere, if you are physically located somewhere, you can appear in court. So they use that. That's definitely one of those words of art where there's a lay meaning, what you and I think of it as, and then there's a completely different meaning that lawyers use or when you're actually physically in court. So to try to break this down, if you were to, let's say a traffic ticket was filed against you and you attacked it, you defended against it by filing a demur or a motion to dismiss where you're saying that there is no jurisdiction, you can be physically standing in the courtroom in front of the bar. Hell, you could get on top of the bar. You can get on top of the judge's bench, but you're not appearing in the case or in the proceeding, because even though you're physically there, you're not appearing because you're challenging the jurisdiction. So that's one of those doublespeak words which have completely different meanings depending on the context in which it's used. And I believe it's done on purpose. I mean, because most people, well, you appeared. So if you appeared, there must be jurisdiction, and so you get that play on words, you know, that kind of word trap.
Right, and of course, I think that we also have to, at this point, back to the whole game show in the foreign country thing, the legal system is so inaccessible, unintelligible, really, to people who cannot afford these really high-priced attorneys, and what I think most people, if they make an honest assessment of what they see as the so-called justice system in this country, they see former professional athletes and pop stars getting away with murder and all other kinds of abuse, while the system on a day-to-day basis, especially in the traffic court sense, is basically just a method of extorting money from people who don't have the resources to understand the law. So we start with this one word appearance that has these two very different definitions, then what happens?
Well, I want to make, and I do want to point out, and this is one of the things that I was very happy with the success of Adventures in Legal Land, and that it showed people you do not need to really have, you don't need to be an attorney to go into court and have a ticket thrown out or a drug case or, you know, taxes.
Right.
I think if we approach it and whatever words that they're throwing out at us, I because all I do is ask questions. I always recommend you just ask questions. That's really all you're doing. If you listen to my recordings with tax agents and whatnot, you'll almost never hear me quote any law or cite a law. There's no real need to do that. So what you're doing is you're taking the words that they're using against you, and you're just questioning them on that. So, for example, if a judge is insisting he has jurisdiction because you've made an appearance, without getting into any of the actual legalese of that, if we just question him on it, say, oh, wait a minute, does... So take the words that he's feeding you in a desperate attempt to fool you. And so if you just say, wait a minute, are you telling me that your jurisdiction relies on my physical appearance in the court? You just ask him to clarify the nonsense, the legalese that he's trying to put forth on you. And most of it, at least if not all, the legalese that they will throw at you, if you just question them on that, it breaks down quite easily. You know, where they may explain to you, or they may not. Obviously, if they don't want to answer the question, Brett, you caught them with their pants down.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a very effective way, and I believe it's just a very simple, effective model, just for people to be able to break through the legalese without going through the worry or the anxiety. Like, what if they say this? Well, then question them on it. It's an anxiety and it's an expectation that is definitely put in place on purpose. That's why they talk about contempt and the judge wears a black robe and sits 4 feet off the floor and whatnot. So it's a very easy model to learn. It's not necessarily the easiest one to put into practice.
Right, and I think that what you're saying is consistent with the advice that I give on the show frequently for non-legal matters, but dealing with, social, political, educational, economic arguments, is that you should be asking people questions. And, when you're dealing with any sort of mythological, tenuous belief system, it only takes a handful of thoughtful questions, if that, to make it collapse. And I remember listening to you relate one of your experiences where you were basically removed from the court by the judge or at his command by security for asking some of these questions. And your approach was you kind of go in with, for lack of a better word, the olive branch saying, well, I've prepared this guilty plea that I just haven't put my signature to yet, and I just have some basic questions that I'd like to get answered beforehand, and then maybe I'll sign it and plead guilty because I don't have time to go through the whole trial. Is that pretty much what you did or what you recommend?
Yeah, I recommend going in with an unsigned plea of guilty or no lo contendere, no contest, because it's setting a context. It's creating a context. I'm avoiding one context and changing it to where I'm not a combatant. And so they're less likely to fight me when I start asking the questions.
And this seems like generally a better approach than, from listening to Free Talk Live for years and some of the stuff I've seen online, there's a lot of people out there who claim that it's just a matter of knowing certain magic words and using certain magic words. Like, you don't call your car a car, you call it a vessel, and then when that happens, the cops leave you alone. Don't call the road a road. Call it, this other term, and then you just become immune from the aggression of these people. And the consensus has been that that really doesn't work. But the approach of just getting them to acknowledge or to break down the language that they're using, because I think what's particularly insidious about this is they're using words, they're saying these same words in the legal context, while the person standing in front of them, facing, some kind of traffic violation, is hearing them and understanding them in more of a common context. And that's the real trickery.
Yeah, and I don't believe in engaging in the word game in that particular manner, just using different words and trying to to use different words from them. You just engage in your own doublespeak to a degree. And that's why I found it was very, very effective to just, let's say you're in traffic and the police officer has cited you for something. Now, keep in mind that he's playing a word game on you just as much as the judge and the prosecutor, maybe, if there is one. Because he's not giving factual statements on the ticket. He's giving legal allegations,
mm-hmm,
or legal conclusions. And I found real fast, in fact, I was a little surprised at first. I understand it completely now after so many more years' experience, but at first it was like, whoa, what's going on here? If you just put the police officer on the stand and hand him a copy of the statute that you're accused of violating and ask him to read it into the record, typically that's enough to have him to have the prosecutor or the judge refuse to allow it. Because what happens then, let's say they cite you for driving on a suspended license. Now, there's a lot going on with those words right there. So basically it says, no person shall drive on a highway in this state or drive a motor vehicle on a highway within this state at a time when his privilege to do so has been suspended. That's a pretty generic driving on a suspended license statute.
Sure.
So having the police officer on the stand when now he's under oath now, he's testifying under penalty of perjury, and he's fully subject to cross-examination. Any witness is subject to cross-examination on competency and credibility. And so let's just say for in the sake of argument, the judge has allowed him to answer that that is the charge. Yes, this is the statute I charge you with violating. If you just ask him, tell me, sir, what does the word privilege mean legally? That's enough to have the prosecutor and the judge declare him incompetent. And we've done this. We've been successful doing that. What's been reported to me, 100% of the time, they will always stop the cross-examination at that point or not allow the cop to answer those questions. Because what you're doing is you're taking his doublespeak, this legalese, this legalistic gibberish, this privilege and license and state, and all you're asking him to do is tell you what he thinks it means legally.
Uh-huh.
Which he should be able to tell you that because he wrote a ticket and filed it into the court as if he was an attorney. So because he's subject to cross-examination, as you and I would be if we made the same statements, he's required to answer that, or his testimony has to be stricken. But the point for the show is you're doing is you're asking questions and you're asking for a verification of what he's already said. These are the words you use, sir. What in the world do they mean?
Yeah, clever, too, because it's taking one of the best assets of the state and kind of using it against them, and that asset is obedience. I mean, obedience, mass obedience for the population works so well for accomplishing so many things for the people in power and the people who want to exercise or benefit from the exercise of power over others. Cops... some of the most obedient people out there. I'm just doing my job. I'm just following my orders. I think that I remember a story from a couple of years ago. Certain police departments did not want recruits that had above a certain IQ because they thought it would lead to them questioning some of their duties. So when you do ask a question like, all right, well, let's actually you should take a look at what you did here and explain to the court for the record your assessment of this word legally, and they kind of freeze up. I guess that would be one way to get them dismissed as a witness. Is that what happens for incompetence?
Yes, the judge. Well, what typically happens is the prosecutor will usually 9 times out of 10 will jump out of his chair and raise his voice, if not yell.
Mm-hmm.
Objection calls for legal conclusion. The witness is incompetent to testify. Or they'll say the same thing with different words. They'll say, it calls for legal conclusion outside the scope of the witness's testimony, or he's only here to testify to the facts. Well, that may be your intention, sir, but you put his butt on the stand. You opened up your witness to cross-examination, which includes questioning on all prior testimony and questioning him for impeachment purposes for competency and credibility. We all go, I mean, that's like, that's just basic, that's been part of the Anglo-American legal system for, almost a millennium now. That's the be-all, end-all of a trial. I mean, even the Supreme Court of the United States has begrudgingly agreed that the cross-examination is the trial.
Yes.
That's the whole thing, because the evidence, the allegation and the evidence to support it, that is what is on trial. When you do that, not necessarily the defendant, yeah, his life may be on the line, but what is on trial, what is being tried, is there sufficient evidence to support these allegations? And so that's why they put the police officer on the stand. And I like how you mentioned before, it's using the best aspect of this against them, because the hallmark of the American system happens to be the cross-examination.
Right, yes.
And that's where you get them.
And even though this might not relate directly to the topic of doublespeak, I'm kind of curious because I've heard this before and I want to see if this is actually true, if this actually works. Can you get the witness, if the witness is the cop, impeached on the basis that the court shows preferential treatment to them? Is that a real thing?
Well, yes, if you can show that there is an improper or that if there is a relationship between the witness and or any witness and the judge, that should be grounds. See, that's why I'll ask. And my whole thing, people are, what's your method? I just ask questions. If you want to know what I do, look at something like Columbo, which is just asking questions and not taking it, and not taking a position unless it's one that I've gotten the judge or the prosecutor or the IRS agent to take first. I just take what they give me and feed it back to them in the form of a question.
And now, when it comes to the tax system, another whole area just laden with all kinds of difficult language and doublespeak, what kind of advising do you do in that area?
Well, if you look at just words, I advise people to always question, because even more so with taxes, it's all a word game. It's all bluff. It's 100% bluff. And it's all based on words. And so if you look at something like taxpayer, one of the most effective ways of stopping a tax collector from coming after you, one of these professional predators, is to just question him on that word. I mean, you can ask him some setup questions. Look, if I wasn't a taxpayer, would this be legitimate? Would you collect from me? They'll tell you, well, no, of course not. But there, in their mind, you absolutely are a taxpayer. So a very effective way is say, look, factually, what is a taxpayer? Or what are the factual differences, if any, between a taxpayer and a non-taxpayer? That, to me, has been extremely effective in one-on-one communication with the agents and getting them to realize, hey, whoa, wait a minute. I may not have as solid legal ground here as I thought. And it's just that simple. I'm not saying if you ask these questions to a tax agent, they're automatically going to throw their hands up and say no. That's ignoring the whole nature of these agents, their whole psychological and social makeup. But it has been very effective, and at least gets the ball rolling in most cases where you are producing a factual record, so that later if you say I want this assessment thrown out because it is arbitrary and capricious, and say, well, what are you basing that on? Well, I asked you what the factual difference is between taxable income and income, and you weren't able to give me any evidence, if any. So you're able to produce facts, so you're coming at them with facts. They're only hitting you back with their admittedly arbitrary legal opinions. They're doublespeak.
And parroting things that they've heard, because these are all professions where people generally do not ask questions about procedure or about the nature of their job. I mean, I think about, people who work in education or people who are police or people who work for the IRS. These are not people who sit in bed for an hour each night just like really questioning the nature of their job, because sooner or later a day would come where they could not get up and go to work anymore if they were decent people. So I think that's important as well. And again, that's using the best asset of the state against the state, that these people who work for the state have to be incredibly non-inquisitive and obedient. And I think that people supporting the state obviously have to be the same way. And I think that this really also speaks to the power of propaganda and manipulation. When we look at how divergent the meanings of certain words can be from what we understand them to mean and what they understand in the context of the tax system or the legal system, from there, once these definitions are accepted at face value, people can start building arguments using these misleading definitions, and no one questioned the actual grammar, no one questioned the actual language or the meaning, and now they're constructing more complex arguments, which also might be completely fallacious, but people are just taking it in because they don't know any better and they're not asking questions, and of course, these are the authorities and I do what I'm told to avoid trouble.
Yeah, and if a real quick example of the doublespeak and how they cannot, they will actually resist you when you start bringing these issues up and you've double binded them. You put them in a double bind. So one example is with a tax agent in Sacramento with the Franchise Tax Board in California, where knowing the system as I do and how I frame questions a certain way, and I'm trying to get certain admissions that I know they will contradict later because I understand it's doublespeak. So what I had asked this agent, because all I do revolves around what is the evidence, what's the evidence, what does the evidence tell you, if any. And so I asked her, I said, and I can do this with an attorney. She understands it a lot better than a regular tax agent. So I said, look, as an attorney, you would agree that any information given under threat, duress, and coercion would not be admissible in court. And she said, right. She agrees. She said, well, yeah, you're right. And would not. So I said, oh, well. So then I take it, so we're on the same, since we're on the same page, that there is no admissible evidence against my client, you'll be dropping the assessment. She says, well, I didn't agree to that. I said, well, yeah, you said any information given under threat, duress, and coercion would be inadmissible, and the only evidence that you claim to have is a W-4 or a 1099. Well, that's all given under threat, duress, and coercion.
Right.
So what it came down to was that in her mind, when the guard, and she actually said this, when the government orders you to do it or requires you to do it, it is not threat, duress, and coercion. And I said, okay, wait, so you're hung up on a word. So the facts are exactly the same. There's threat, duress, and coercion. You're forced to do something. But when you put the label government on it, because that includes you, you don't think that, for some reason, you don't think that's a threat. Guys, could you explain how that's different factually? Just explain. Well, it's an operation of law, which was that, and I had to tell her. Now, again, you do understand there's absolutely no context to the sentence you just said.
Right.
Yeah. So she had actually said to me, I'm having a very difficult time communicating with you. And I said, well, the reason why is I'm asking for facts. You keep giving me opinions. And we can't communicate that way. You actually have to be responsive. We have to be responsive to each other. But she actually, and I'm taking her at a word, Brett, when she used the phrase or the sentence, it's an operation of law, I don't think she really understood at that point that there was no content in what she said.
Yeah, yeah.
But I doubt she went home that night and thought about the conversation that we had. And I doubt she gave any kind of critical thought to what facts would lead a normal, reasonable, rational adult to believe that when you force someone to do something in one context, it's not forcing them to do it in another. Again, the critical thought is not taught, and I think it absolutely starts in the school because they teach you to be a citizen, but they never actually tell you what the word means.
Oh, that's a good one, too. Yeah, let's talk about that for a minute. Citizen.
You'll see in grade school, and I have a child here, Jenny. Oh, Jenny, were you taught citizenship in school?
Yeah.
Yeah, did they tell you what citizenship what was?
Niceness.
Thank you. You did that. But she said they taught that citizenship was niceness. So if they actually taught you what citizen was, then people would start thinking critically, of course, like you mentioned, but they're not going to do that in school because, well, that would undermine their entire system if somebody was actually – because and right on point when you talk about doublespeak, the phrase free citizen is an oxymoron.
Mm-hmm.
It's not proper English other than as an oxymoron, but they'll never teach you that.
Right, and I think, too, that before you get to being able to have a debate or being able to form more complex arguments, you have to be very clear on meanings and language. And I was saying in the first installment of this series, sometimes I'll stop a discussion. Like, if people keep using the word defense as an umbrella term for the actions of the United States military, I say, look, we can't go any further because we do not agree on language here. Like, when I think of that word, or when I think of this institution, I see violence, I see aggression, I see property destruction, I see genocide, all being funded by the threat of force. And, you know, you might picture a ticker tape parade or Torah, 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 or the best years of our lives, and like, we're just not, we can't go forward from there. So I think getting the language clear, and people will use citizen as a word that's like, oh, I'm a tax-paying citizen, as if there should be a medal for that. But a citizen, the definition is a person who owes an obligation of allegiance in exchange for duty of protection. Is that correct?
It's pretty much there. A citizen is a member of the body politic.
Mm-hmm.
Who owes a duty of allegiance in return for duty of protection at their reciprocal obligations. Because you can be... there can be a duty of protection and a duty of allegiance, presumed for a resident who is not necessarily a citizen, because a resident isn't necessarily a member of the body politic like the citizen is. So there's a fine distinction there.
So reciprocal obligation is just a contract, right? Essentially.
Yes, right. Absolutely. And when the Supreme Court in Laurier versus United States said that each is a consideration for the other, they're speaking contract language.
Yeah, exactly. So the last question that I have, because you are comfortable confronting people, and of course this takes, to do this kind of stuff in court or to do this kind of stuff with the IRS takes a great deal of courage, and I'm sure in the background it took a great deal of research, but because you're able to put people into these corners just with this inquisitive Socratic approach, is it right for me to think that you probably get yelled at or threatened from time to time?
Yeah. I wrote in the book that I was not only thrown out of one courtroom, I was thrown out of the court building. And then I went to the courthouse across the street and was thrown out of that building, too. So, yeah, I've been threatened with contempt many times. And I do tell people, when I show people the three questions to have a ticket thrown out, or even the two questions, you have to expect a certain emotional response from them. Like when we, because it's kind of like the judge feels, oh, you SOB, you weren't really coming in here to plead guilty, you just played me. And so when you can get a judge, and in three questions undermine his entire pretense of legitimacy, okay, and you cut through all the doublespeak, and people can see clearly, it's like, hey, this is not an emperor, and this is just some naked idiot. They're gonna take some offense to that, and yes, they will get a moment. Doesn't mean they're gonna be yelling and screaming. That's why I recommend people bring in media reps and let them know ahead of time that the media is there, so they don't launch into these 5-year-old rants and whatnot. Because I asked the judge who he represents, or I had the audacity to question a cop on cross examination and ask him, "What is the nature of your relationship to the judge?"
Right, and I think that, too, we can see this. The reason why I ask this question is because, obviously, I have a lot of younger listeners who, as they try to point more of the realities of the state out to people who've just accepted or are ignoring these realities, they're going to deal with more confrontations. And I think that when I first started trying to do this, it was kind of intimidating. And it kind of would push me back at first, like, well, you know, these people are older and these people have more experience and maybe I'm wrong. But to kind of keep pushing forward, people don't like it when they feel a belief system that gives them comfort, or worse yet, a belief system that they're drawing benefits from is being challenged, they kind of go into attack mode. So how do you, I guess the question in all of this is there anything special that you would do to prepare for that? Or is that just kind of like an ongoing process?
Well, to some of them, they're always going to take it personal. I mean, you're attacking their map of the world, their perception of reality. And some of them are going to take it personal. What I do, knowing that, I always want to go with the path of least resistance. I want to make it as easy as possible for the individual, whether it's the judge or it's a tax agent, whoever has the authority to stop this attack. I want to create a context where the easiest thing for him to do is to stop it. And I've found that if I attack your, a serious generalization or map that you have of the world, I'm not going to do it. My chances are very mm-hmm. slim. But if I can scapegoat somebody and take advantage of one of a generalization you hold very dear, that's great. And that's why we've been so successful getting tickets thrown out. And my speculation, when we scapegoat the cop,
right,
or the prosecutor, because we're not attacking the system itself. What we're doing is using the system against itself, and we're taking advantage of a generalization the judge holds very near and dear, that cross-examination is the heart of the American legal system.
Yeah.
It's adversarial, okay? And that the everyone has a substantive due process right to confront their accuser, and that the prosecution has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I take advantage of that public. I know that's ridiculous. I know it's not true. I know they're all lies. But I can use that to my advantage because the judge, the gatekeeper, he holds it dear. And so we give him the opportunity to scapegoat the cop. It's not because Mark has any valid arguments. It's just the fact the cop wasn't prepared, or the prosecutor wasn't prepared. It's the same thing in tax issues. It's not because the system is based on violence and completely irrational and nobody owes anything. It's just because this particular agent wasn't prepared against Mark.
Right.
And so it's nice and neat and clean. And nobody has to admit that any of my conclusions were right, or that my view of the world is right, that I have the right model, that my perceptions are more accurate reflections of reality than the judge, because I'm not going to do that. I tell people in workshops and on the show, the judge is the only acknowledged legal expert in that room. Don't fight it, because it's a losing battle. But it's something that you can use to your advantage, because if he starts contradicting himself, he can't maintain his perception of legitimacy anymore, and he's going to be more inclined to get you out of there.
Right. For your purposes, for the practical purpose of being successful on this day in court, that absolutely makes sense, because I think that what you're saying is, if somebody goes in there and says to the judge, look, I'm here to put the system on trial and your whole purpose in life on trial, that's gonna go down in flames. But just to show the incompetence of the other person using some of their own trickery against them has proven to be very effective.
Well, it allows them to maintain their fictions, and even though they know their fictions now. Mm-hmm. It may be the first time it came out, but it allows them to continue maintaining their fictions, and their little world does not have to change much, because I don't know how many tickets now have been thrown out. They're still giving them out. It hasn't made a dent, and I've said for a long time, the purpose there is not – it's one tool out of many to help bring about a voluntary society, and it's damage control. Mm. I am showing whether we win or whether the ticket's thrown out or whether they're convicted. We've shown the system to be a complete and utter fraud to anybody who's paying attention.
Exactly, yeah, and I think that that's consistent with my approach as well, where the reason why I do this show and the reason why I have this message is because I'm interested in, you know, talking to young people, people who still have a chance to reevaluate some of the beliefs that they've started to form. And I think when you're going after cops and judges, that's obviously a very frustrating, very uphill, and more often than not, a losing battle. So what can we plug for you, Mark, in addition to Adventures in Legal Land and the No State Project? What do you have going on right now?
Well, the No State Project course is every Saturday right here on LRN.FM, 4 to 7 Eastern Time. We're going to be at Libertopia, so I want everyone to know about Libertopia in San Diego, the weekend of the 23rd. And we're also getting in the works for September 2012, a No State Fair in Austin, and together with the Contraband Turkey Roast.
Nice. All right, well, it has been great having you on. Of course, it was long overdue, and I look forward to having another conversation with you again sometime in the future.
I appreciate it, Brett. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mark.
We've suffered the worst, and we've been hurt. You were hurt by his words.
Were you hurt
in injury?
I sustained an injury, but I was
initially hurt with his words.
In 10 years, we're gonna have 1 million lawyers. 1 million lawyers. 1 million lawyers. In 10 years, we're gonna have 1 million lawyers. How much can the poor nation stand? Oh, a suffering world cries for mercy as far as the eye can see. Lawyers around every bend in the road, lawyers in every tree. Lawyers in restaurants, lawyers in clubs, lawyers behind every door. Behind windows and potted plants, shade trees and shrubs, lawyers on pogo sticks, lawyers in politics.